For the past four decades, Judith Leigh has been a very familiar voice to many Manx Radio listeners, especially early on a Sunday and late the same evening. As well as being the station's religious correspondent, she's also a crucial figure in the annual coverage of the Guild. But just who the hell is Judith Leigh? This is the first of a two-part Island Life special.
I first came to the Isle of Man on holiday in, I would think, about 1984 or 85. I can't remember the exact year, but I can remember the weather was atrocious. Now, my father had been to the island lots of times. He absolutely loved the island. He had a friend over here, and he used to come over as often as he could and stayed in Ramsey, played golf everywhere around the island. That was my father's big thing in his retirement. And he loved the island, and he said to me, "You've got to come." So he and I came on holiday. It was a Tuesday morning. We came on the little plane, we stepped off, and I've never seen rain like it. It looked like the rain was coming in every possible direction. We had booked a hire car, and we went out of the other side of the airport. And I can remember looking at that, you know, the sculpture outside, and the rain was, and it was misty, and the rain was roaring around it. And I thought, this is the most magical place I've ever seen. We were only here for a few days. It was just a little sort of mini break. And the weather really didn't let up the whole time. We got everything. We just added wind to the mix. But there was something about the island. And I remember thinking, I remember distinctly thinking, one day, I don't care if I'm 190 and I can hardly walk, one day I want to live here. I so badly want to live here. Now, the way things worked out, I got to live here much sooner than I thought. In fact, it was just a few years later, probably about 3 years later, something like that, that I was able to move over just by one of those weird mixtures of circumstance that you can't predict. Just when all the pieces of the jigsaw kind of said, go and live in the Isle of Man. And so I did. The love affair has never got any less. In fact, it's got more. Not only do I love the island even more, but also I acknowledge that I'm doing things and have done since I've been here that I would never have got to do if I'd stayed in Cheshire, which is where I was living at the time. Grew up in Liverpool, and I feel very nostalgic when I go back, not so much to Cheshire, but to Liverpool I go back, because where I grew up has not changed. The built environment has not changed one bit.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment, because I just want to know more about that first trip. You know, where did you go? What did you do? What can you recall of that first trip?
I need to kind of sketch in a bit about how my father came to come over here.
Okay.
Because there were two families, my family and another family, who were all great friends. In the family that we were friends with, there were two priests, Roman Catholic priests. And my father was particularly friendly with one of them because they had a shared passion for cars, tinkering with cars. Our priest friend was a specialist in Alfa Romeo. He knew everything about every different genre of the car that had been made. And so my father enjoyed talking cars with Jim. Father Jim got sent over here, and Roman Catholic priests don't have, well, certainly not in those days, a huge choice. If the bishop says, in your archdiocese, says, we'd like you to go to X parish, you go. It's an obedience thing. And so Father Jim came over here to the Catholic Church in Ramsey. Of course, he said, Jim loved the island, and he said to my father, oh, come and stay. So my father, that was where my father used to come several times a year, stay in the priest's house in Ramsey, play golf, cook nice meals for Jim. Jim would bring some friends, parishioners around. It was a nice kind of social week for everybody. When I started to come over with my father, he'd made Ramsey the base, so we would stay at the Grand Island, which I thought was the height of elegance. But of course, when you come with a church connection, it's an easy way to make lots of friends, because you go to services and people are very welcoming. It's a very short step before people start inviting you to their homes and including you in their social life. The first trip, to be honest with you, we didn't do an awful lot except drove around, and despite the wind and the rain, and my father was showing me all his favourite places, you know, because he'd done quite a bit of exploring. So that was pretty much all we did. As I say, it was just a mini break. And then I came back whenever I could, and we had a lot of much better weather. The house that I lived in for 36, 7 years was actually the house that my father was planning on living in. He wanted to spend half and half of his time, half on the island. He wanted to have his home here and half back in Cheshire. It was a Saturday afternoon and we were going to the point of air. Now, it has to be said that sense of direction is not my strongest suit. Okay. He was driving. I had the map. I'm afraid I had the map upside down.
You ended up at the cough.
Well, not quite. We ended up on Lizaire Road heading towards Sulby, which, OK, it's not a million miles, but it wasn't the best route from Ramsey to the Point of Ayr. There was a house for sale on the sign. We saw the sailboard and my father said, stop, we're going to stop there. We never got to the Point of Ayr that day. The house was empty. We sat outside looking at it and my father just fell in love with it, went away, made an offer for it and bought the house. Then he changed his plans a few months later before he actually moved in and decided that he didn't want to live in the Isle of Man, that he wanted to stay in Cheshire and continue to visit. I couldn't bear the thought of the house going, and so I bought the house from him.
Wow.
And that was why I moved over.
All right. OK. Before we come into the Isle of Man, let's go back then to your childhood. So you said you were from Liverpool. What part of Liverpool?
South Liverpool. Aigburth was where I grew up. Lived there for 12 years. And then we moved. We lived in with my grandma and my mother's brother, my uncle, who was really like a brother to me, my parents and myself. When I was 12, we moved only a few miles, still South Liverpool. We moved to Allerton, a few steps away from Fourth Lynn Road. That might be familiar to anybody who's interested in the Beatles.
Right, okay. That's where Paul McCartney lived, 24th Lynn Road.
So lived in Allerton and had a very interesting next-door neighbour, Bill Kenwright.
Oh, the theatre impresario.
Impresario, yeah. Except he wasn't a theatre impresario then.
Okay.
He was a teenager, a few years older than myself, and he and his brother were desperate to be Beatles. They would be in the garage with a drummer friend of theirs making the most fearful racket, and because they didn't really break into the music business. And then Bill Kenwright went into acting and he was in Coronation Street.
That's right, yeah.
And he did very nicely there. But that really wasn't he wasn't completely comfortable there. However, of course, it was a stepping stone then to the acting world and he discovered that what he really was good at was being an impresario.
Oh, yeah.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
So you got to know Bill quite well?
No, I didn't. I didn't because there was that bit of an age gap. However, not so many years ago, you know, Blood Brothers was one of the shows that he was particularly fond of. Bill Kenwright, really, of all the things that he put on, he loved that show. And they were reprising it again. I mean, it's never off the stage somewhere. But it was back at the Empire in Liverpool. And he directed that particular production. So I loved the show. I went simply because I loved the show. I went to see it. And he was there. He was back in the sound. And I went in the interval. I went. And he was always such a friendly person, you know, in any of the shows. And I went and I said, "You don't know me." But I said, "We grew up next door to each other." And he was so lovely. There was a teenager lived on the other side of us. It was a sort of a corner of the road, a corner of two roads. And he said, "You weren't the naughty one, were you?" I said, "No, sadly, I wasn't. She was the one who lived on the other side." But I do know she had a massive crush on him. And she used to ride her bike round and round the house in the hope that, you know, round the block, in the hope. But she, as far as I know, she didn't get a moment. But I'd love to know why he thought she was the naughty one.
Have you lost the accent or did you never have? Because obviously Aigburth and it's near the river, etc.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All of my family have the accent.
But you?
And, well, I went to a school that, and I'll bear in mind, this is when dinosaurs roamed the land. You know, that we're going back to, I was born in 1951. Let's put it in context.
Right.
So
the 50s.
Going to school in the 50s. I went to a school that I look back on it with great affection because really what they wanted, now whether it's right or wrong is people's opinion, but what they wanted to do was equip us for life.
Okay.
And they thought, like I say, rightly or wrongly, that not having an accent would be, you could fit in anywhere. There were a lot of life skills that might seem wrong or dated now, but that's what they were trying to do. And so we were, elocution lessons were part of.
Right. So they worked on you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your family were happy with this?
Well, yes, because you see, it was from the same. They thought, oh, well, that'll help you to get on in life, you know.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about life in Liverpool in the 50s. Because obviously, I'm guessing no television. You had the radio. You'd listen to the radio at night. Well, just give me a flavour of what growing up, those first pre-teenage years in Egbeth were like.
Very simple and very straightforward. And that's what I think is possibly missing. And I say that with a sadness, not because I'm not one of these people who says, oh, back in my day, you know, we didn't do this. And we didn't have the temptations. You know, you were thrown on your own imagination and family things. Family life was, well, for example, on a Sunday in our family, there was always going to church, and then it would be visiting. We would go and see my great aunt, and then we'd go and see the other grandparents that we didn't live with. You know, so that was very much a stronghold of your Sundays.
With those visits, would you be sat there just while the adults talked? Or would you just have to sit there, or would you engage? Or,
oh no, well you're right. It was just sitting down because you didn't join an adult conversation. Mm. But I was very lucky because the grandma that we used to go and visit, she was great. I had a wonderful collection of dolls and teddy bears and all this kind of thing. Mm. And she was great at making clothes for them. And so there'd always be something she'd made. So I'd take my favourite doll or whatever, you see, and so I would have that to occupy me and having a look and see what she'd made and all that kind of thing. And then there was always the garden, you know. And when you're little, the garden's huge, isn't it? No matter, they mysteriously shrink when we get older, don't they? I don't know how that is, but anyway. So you'd be allowed to go out and play in the garden and you potter around and that kind of thing. And that was primary school age. It was a much simpler, sort of straightforward. Mm. And you're right, there wasn't television. The radio was always on.
And you'd listen to?
Well, it was the Light programme. It was Housewives' Choice. It was it was all of that stuff. That was the kind of the background to growing up. Listen with mother when I was younger, you know. And this is why I was very comfortable when we used to have to read the shipping forecast, because the big shipping forecast always preceded Listen with Mother in the 50s. Mm. And so when the radio was turned on, ready for Listen with Mother, you got the music of the shipping forecast. It was a simpler kind of way of life. But the things that happened were bigger treats. Mm. For example, there weren't lots of holidays. During this time, my father was working all the hours because he was trying to set up his business. He was working very, very long hours, and there wasn't a lot of money, which was true of a lot of people in those times. So there weren't holidays and that kind of thing, but a day trip to New Brighton, you know, going on the ferry, going off to New Brighton, it was really exciting. Going on the train to Southport, that was great, you know, and those kind of things that were really appreciated. And if there was something that you wanted, and it was perhaps, well, you can have that when you're older. And so it was something to look forward to. So in a way, there was quite a bit more excitement and anticipation in life. There wasn't, things were not so easily come by.
You keep mentioning your father, but where's your mother in all of this?
Oh, my mother was in all of it. I have to say that when I look back now with adult eyes, they were not easy years at all, because the reason we were living with my grandma and my uncle was because both of them were very ill. So my parents, newly married, with me as a very young baby, well, they'd been married a couple of years and come along. My grandma and my uncle were very ill, and the only solution was for my parents to go and live there. So my mother was doing a lot of the looking after them and looking after me. My father was working hard to start his business. When things got a bit more stable domestically, my grandma was a lot more stable health-wise. She would look after me, and my mother went and helped my father in the business. And so there was always a lot going on domestically. It was a busy household with lots of responsibilities to be dealt with.
And you are the classic example of an only child, as in you don't have any brothers or sisters?
There's only me. My mother said numerous times if she'd known how I was going to turn out, she'd have left me on a doorstep. But when she realised that, she also realised I would have brought myself home again. So that was a bit of a non-starter, you know. And I'm sure, you know, there are a lot of people who would say the same thing, that back in the 50s, life was busy. There was a lot to do just to get by. Mm. And that was very true of our household. And there were other family members. My grandma's sister, she was unwell. She lost her husband very suddenly. And that was all of that to be dealt with. Mm. So, you know, there was always a lot going on. Mm. When I was 18, by this time, my grandma's health had collapsed. And she was being cared for. And my uncle had blossomed, and he was fine, and he had got married, and so he was living his life. My parents looked at each other and realised that they didn't have a relationship. They were wonderful people who got married for the wrong reasons back in the late 1940s, after the war, you know, and they married each other thinking that they could change each other. My father was a good, solid, dependable type. He wasn't a bit romantic. My mother was very romantic, quite not nervous, but a person who needs somebody to lean on. My father thought he could make my mother more courageous. My mother thought she could make my father more romantic. And you can't. We are what we are, aren't we? And so when all the busyness calmed down, there was nothing there. And so they agreed to separate. There was nobody else. Mm. And so they split up. I have to be honest and say, my mother, who was a home bird at heart, she never recovered from that. She lived her life. But she never really, what she needed was a stable marriage. And so they split up. And
how old were you at this point?
I was just, I'd just left school. I was just turned 18.
So you weren't a small child. So, but I mean, that would have affected you as well.
It did. It was decided for me that I would live with my mother. And I do remember vividly the day that my father was staying in the house that we were in, and my mother and I were moving to a flat. And I remember suddenly thinking, my childhood is over. Now, I know that's a ridiculous thing to say to today's 18-year-olds.
But it's putting a full stop on it, isn't it, though?
Yeah. Yes. What I think when I say, I don't mean childhood, that's probably the wrong word. I suppose what I mean, that sort of carefree where you came home and your tea was on the table and you could please yourself what you did. And
the family unit has gone.
Yeah. You know. And I knew, because I knew that my mother really couldn't cope with this, the separation. And I knew that I would be responsible for her, which I was, you know, but you don't know then how things are going to work out. We deal with what's in front of us, don't we?
We do. You divided your time between the two?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I love them both deeply. And the irony of it was, the supreme irony was that this was a long, long time ago, but they ended up, both of them, living with me in two different parts of the house, which was great because they lived into their 90s.
And they were friends still?
No.
No, oh, right, okay. Well, we won't go there.
They weren't, no, they... It was fine. They were never going to piece the relationship together
again. What a shame.
But it was...
What a shame, though.
It was... But they were just lovely people, but just not for each other.
Okay.
But as far as I'm concerned, the fact that I could do my best, I have a lot of regrets, but I tried to look after them.
Mm. Was it a strong religious background in your family?
My grandma was the one. My grandma had a very, very strong faith. And I think that's really... it was on two sides. It was my maternal grandmother had a very, very strong faith. My paternal great-grandmother also had a great faith, but it was a great faith. She was a Methodist. It was born out of seeing the suffering that at the time, bearing in mind that she died, she lived to be in her 90s and died in the, she died just before I was born. She died about 1950, in her 90s. So, you know, work out the generation there. She ran a temperance mission for the women and the children who had nothing. The men who would go, they'd go down to the docks and they'd stand there and see who would get hired and they would get a day's work. They'd get their money and they would walk home and the lights of the pub would be there and the laughter and the warm welcome and they'd go in. And they wouldn't intend to spend the bulk of the money, but the temptation was great. And what she was doing was providing a mission for the women and the children, and she used to bring them in and care for them. So there was that kind of background, and she did that for donkey's years. And a lot of people didn't know her name. They used to call her Little Grandma because she was a very small lady, a very slightly built lady. And she carried on doing that until she went blind. But she was in her 90s then, yeah. You know,
incredible.
Carried on doing that. So there was a strong strand of Methodism there. And my maternal grandmother was very strongly Roman Catholic. My parents, my father, he had a faith, but latterly, he went back to going to church, but not when I was growing up. But he was entirely supportive of me being brought up a Catholic. My parents didn't convert, neither of them changed their religion, which made, in those days, in the 1940s, you couldn't be married in church, in a Catholic church, to a person of another Christian denomination, which was a source of huge sadness to so many people. So they got married in the vestry, which didn't get the marriage off to a good start. And I used to go to church with my grandma.
Just because I wasn't around in there, I have got a Liverpool connection, but I wasn't around that time. There was, from what I understand, a big Protestant / Catholic presence within the city, but it never, I know there were used to the marches, and I think they still have the marches go on today, the Orange Orders, etc., etc. Was that a part of growing up in Liverpool? Obviously, I know that's not a Catholic side, but...
No, I was very much aware of the marches, and it was always, we won't go into town, you know, just simply because there were a load of people there, and, you know, we won't go into town today.
Was that because of your faith, though, because you were Catholic?
No, it was more because just there were lots of people marching about, and it's probably better not. They might get a bit rowdy.
Okay.
You know, that was more more that it was. If there was anything more to that in my family, it was never communicated.
Okay.
But I was aware that there was the Catholic-Protestant divide. And that is what I was even more aware of in later years, how church leaders were determined it was not going to be carried forward.
Good.
You know, and so we saw, you know, the Warlock Shepherd Alliance that went out of their way with the freedom, the moderator of the Free Church also there, and saying, you know, this can't ever, it can't ever be like that. But it wasn't just about Catholic Protestant. It was also about calming down racial tensions, you know, that could have, were bubbling under. I was around at the time of the Toxteth riots and, you know, that
1981.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Just while we're still in Liverpool, every Scouser has a Beatles story. You mentioned the Beatles. Do you have a Beatles story?
A big disappointment to you. I'm sorry. I don't have a Beatles story. I don't. Isn't that awful?
You never, I mean, never saw them or, I mean, like the like going to the cavern or places, that was not on your radar?
That was forbidden, absolutely forbidden. Go to the cabin, it's a death trap, absolute death trap. You know, you can imagine, I'm quoting what's said in our house. No, but there are two things that I grew up with that I am so grateful for. And one is that I grew up surrounded by music. And this was my uncle. He loved music. He would come in with the brown paper bag, with the latest single that he'd bought.
Yeah.
So I grew up with all that, you know, the Everly Brothers and all of that kind of thing of that era, surrounded by music and also with a work ethic. Everybody was busy and committed and getting on with things, not complaining, just getting on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, this is where school went wrong, because I went to school when I was 5 and I had the most enormous school hat and the biggest pair of gloves you've ever seen. Grandma bought them for me, and she said, she'll grow into them. Well, I have to tell you, I stayed at school till I was 18, and I never grew into those blessed gloves, but I never managed to lose them. And I went to school, and my first day at school, and I thought, I don't like this. I really, really don't like this. I wanted to go to work, because I wanted to be like my daddy. He had a car, and he had a briefcase, and he went off every morning looking very purposeful. And I wanted to work. I didn't know what work was, but I knew that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to go out into the world. Because one thing that being an only child is that you learn to play imaginatively. Your imagination. I had my family. I had my dolls and all of them. I had my doll's house furniture. I didn't have a doll's house because we didn't have the space for that. But you can make an imaginary world in the patterns on the carpet and put your furniture out and all the rest of it, and having an imagination that's developed is a great thing. I didn't go looking for somebody to play with. It was now, there you go, off you go and play. And so you did. You got your toys out and you played. So school and I were never really comfortable together.
Okay.
Because there was nothing, the only thing that I loved was English. And I think that we are, as we go through school, we are very much influenced by the quality of teachers. My father, bless him, he would have loved to have had a university education. But he left school when he was 14 because that's what you did. And he got a job straight away. He knew, I think deep in his heart of hearts, he knew I wasn't academic. But he somehow felt that one day I might suddenly develop into something. And I knew I wouldn't, and he thought I might. And we made a deal that I would stay at school till I was 18 and I would do my O-levels as they were then and my A-levels and then see what came out at the end of it. Well, I got some O-levels, but I didn't get any A-levels. And so we called it quits and I went to work. But we had, in my secondary education, we had a brilliant Latin teacher, absolutely brilliant. And of course, we all had to do Latin to O-level because it was a university entrance necessity. And so it was, do your Latin O-level, you might just need it. What I realised afterwards, how much of a key to language it is, to comprehension and spelling and all the rest of it. As the lesser of all evils, I took English at A-level and we had two brilliant teachers and they were just inspirational. I did actually get A-level English, but it was very low grade.
We're talking language or literature?
And I did language and literature,
Yeah.
But it was very low grade, so we won't talk about that because it's no use or ornament, you know.
Okay.
You know, I love Shakespeare, I love theatre, I love reading, all of that. I have done that all my life.
Mm-hmm. So leaving school, and did you know what you wanted to do and what did you do?
No, I hadn't got a clue what to do.
Join us again at the same time next week for part two of Who the Hell is Judith Leigh?
At school, I hadn't got a clue what to do, but I just wrote after jobs. I got a job quite quickly in a import-export agents in the Liver Buildings. It was a huge French company, French-based company. The office in the Liver Buildings, there were about 100 people in it, and that was considered a tiny offshoot. That's how big the company was. And what they were doing then was exporting everything you can think of to West Africa, to all the countries along West African. And I had a very exciting job. I was dealing with groundnut returns. I hadn't a clue what a groundnut was. Not a clue. And I had one of these adding machines that you press the buttons in. No, I don't know why I'm saying you know, because you don't know. It was ancient. You press the buttons in. Physically, they had sticky out plastic buttons and you press them in with the numbers on it, you know. And then you pull the handle and it kind of rumbled along and it came up with a result. And I had to write this down on a form. I think it was essential to the well-being of the company, but it certainly wasn't essential to my well-being. So I did that for a while. And there, I was literally the lowest person. And that was fine. It was a job. And the excitement of the head of the cash department coming round on a Friday with your little brown envelope with your £5 in. Well, that was just, you could go to CNA's and buy a dress then, if you were so minded. And so it was work. And it was in a department with about six girls and two guys who were the heads of the department. I did graduate from the groundnuts to doing insurance because there was a lot of insurance for the, on all the consignments and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And also that the office in Liverpool did all the insurance of all the vehicles that belonged to the company in West Africa. So there was all that kind of stuff and dealing with cover notes and policies and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I thought, crumbs, this is a bit off. Then there was something, I can't remember what it was, but there was some paperwork that needed to be done by the office in Manchester. And I was in the privileged position, eventually, of being, and maybe because they thought that I would be okay on a train. And I got sent to Manchester. I wish I could remember what it was that I had to do. But there was an office in Whitworth Street. And that was fascinating because it was an ancient building. They had a Victorian building where they had offices on one side of the corridor and warehousing on the other side. But it was all in the same building. This was fascinating because you could kind of see what was going on in the warehouse. And I remember the only thing that stood out in my mind was that in this section was all optical goods, telescopes and binoculars and some very expensive telescopes. Mm. And one of them had been stolen, much to the chagrin of the warehouse manager. And so he was asked what he planned to do about this. And he said, "I'm going to set a trap." And so he put out another expensive telescope. And guess what? That was stolen as well. But they still didn't find the culprit. Oh. So I don't think that was... But, I mean, it's ridiculous the things that stick out in your working life. It was a big company, so you got the opportunity to meet other people in other departments. And I met this chap on one of these trips to Manchester. And he said, "I'm leaving. I'm setting up on my own." Oh, I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to sell car radios." Now, let's go back to early 1970s. Only top range cars had any kind of sound system factory fitted, the top end. So the lower end, you bought your radio or you bought your 8-track stereo. Now, he had contacts in Japan, so he'd been given a concession on the retail version of the in-car entertainment that went in Toyotas, and they were very good quality. He said, "Do you fancy leaving and selling car radios?" He said, "You know, you'd have to be self-employed." I'd done about 3 years with this company in Liverpool, up on the seventh floor of the Liver buildings. Every time I get off the boat, I look up, I count seven floors up, and I think, used to be there. Anyway, so I left. Off I went, selling car radios. That was great fun, because my territory was anything from Liverpool up to about Carlisle. The trick was you had a display unit that kind of fitted in the back of your car, and you had the different models in it, and that was sort of wired into your battery. You could go to, it was a garage, you perhaps go to a dealership, the bigger dealership, or you would go to one of the in-car entertainment specialists where you'd take your car to have your radio fitted. And you would try to persuade them that yours was better than Motorola or all the other brands, that Radiomobile, they were our biggest competitors, that yours were better. That was a lot of fun, because it's a good way to hone your selling skills, because garages are not easy. So I was doing that. And I met up with him one day, and he said, "I've been offered these Parker pens. They're from America." He said, "It's all legit." But he said, I can sell them here." So I said, "Well, I don't know what I'd sell pens to." He said, "Oh, well," he said, "I've got some contacts."
He's sounding like Arthur Daly, this chap.
So actually, he wasn't like that at all. He was absolutely on the... The truth of it is, and you've got to listen carefully for the subtext here, Dave, we had no idea what we were doing. The car radio thing was the most straightforward. You buy radios and sell them. That was straightforward. Now we are straying into shark-infested waters. So the next thing he says to me is, "I've just sold 1,000 of those pens." And he said, "The company that I've sold them to, they specialise in very, very high-end optical equipment, you know, very specialised telescopic mounts and this kind of thing." He said, "And I asked them what they're going to do with the pens." And he said, "We're going to give them away." He said, "Who in their right mind gives things away?" I said, "Well, come on, there's got to be more to it than that." And what we discovered, we had just stumbled on incentive marketing. So what these people were doing was perfectly legitimately, if you bought so much product, this was a motivation scheme for the trade. If you bought so much product, you got so many free pens, which then the retailer could sell, or he could give them away to, you know, the 10th customer that he came. It was all above board. But it was a completely new way of marketing that wasn't on buses or hoardings or magazines. It was something that people could buy into, that would build loyalty. This is really interesting. This is something that you can get your teeth into, because what you needed to do was to find an angle of how people could boost their sales, because it was all about boosting sales and building loyalty. That was what it was about. It wasn't something that what was called above-the-line agencies were doing. They were concentrating on selling media. We decided that we would try and get good at this. We would go to big companies. Now, when I say we, sometimes we would make the pitch separately because he was very good. My colleague was very, very good on sourcing items. If I said to him, "I need a pen, But for this particular scheme, it can't cost more than 40 pence printed. And he would go and source it. But I enjoyed the client-facing bit. Mm. I enjoyed making the pitch. Mm. And you had to make a good pitch because there were other people pitching for the business. We were dealing with big companies. They would shop around. They wouldn't just give you business to the first person that came along. And so you had to be creative. But there was so much freedom. For example, we started doing tailor-made competitions for Asda. They wanted, when I say tailor-made, it would just be for all the Asda stores for their customers. And you would think, oh, well, we'll pick some nice upmarket prizes, kitchen stuff that wouldn't be upmarket now, but it was then. Oh, what's topical? We'll call it To the Manor Born. Now you couldn't do that when the Manor Born was on the television. But you could then, there were no rules. It was just about being creative. But of course, you have to get your big breaks. One of the best breaks that I got was that I heard on the grapevine that the BBC were launching breakfast television. And it came to me via, complicated channels, that they wanted mugs, printed coffee mugs, that they could have on the set that they would subsequently give away or use as competition prizes. And they had been let down. And it was going on air in like a couple of days' time. Who can rescue them? I can do it. Because I knew where I could get a short run done. And it was literally driving down to London overnight and arriving at the television centre and saying, there's your mugs. Look what we did. That really, really paid off.
Did that continue, that relationship with?
Yes, it did. Yeah. They were fabulous years because I then did a range of merchandise for the launch of EastEnders. I did One Man His Dog. We did merchandise for Top of the Pops, which was great merchandise for the Wogan show when there used to be Wogan on the television. That was fun because we did a range of merchandise in the house colours, the grey and the pale blue. But that was popular. They loved live audiences for that. But it was very popular with coach trips. But of course, when they came out of television centre, the coach was waiting to take them away. So you had to be there and selling really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Get everybody with their keyrings and their mugs and their pens and all the other stuff that we did. Oh, there was a whole range that we did. The One Man and His Dog mugs were lovely. They were a sort of an oatmeal-y colour with the profile of a man and a dog sitting back view of them sitting side by side. That was great.
Do you have a box in the attic and with some of these things in still from that time that you kept yourself?
No, I haven't. Okay. I've just got photographs of
them.
I just kept the photographs. I couldn't.
Okay.
You had to kind of draw a line.
So that seems really thrilling.
But
it was great. Yeah.
It was great because I was down every week seeing what they wanted, and then we were processing the orders. But of course, it has its dangerous downside. We did a range of clothing for the Late Late Breakfast Show for Noel Edmonds, and it was the first time we'd done a plastic print on a sweatshirt. They wanted some a little bit different, and so we did slightly different colours. There was a lovely blue, and there was a fuchsia colour, and there was a nice shade of green, and he wore one of them on the show. That was a Saturday night. Within 48 hours, we had £35,000 worth of orders for the clothing. The following weekend, there was that
accident.
Dreadful accident, and nobody wanted the clothing.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that was just the end of it. And so it's not dealing with those kind of things. There are the upsides and the downsides. Mm.
So I'll just mention the fact that if anyone's wondering what it was, there was a stunt. There was every week they had a member of the public would take part in a stunt, and unfortunately for the programme, it went wrong with the worst possible result.
The only reason I mention that is to show that business is not all fun. You do get and there were lots of times, lots of pictures I didn't get. And that's good for you because it sharpens the edge. What happened with the BBC was quite understandably, they were happy for me to get all this merchandise in just for so long. And then they realised that they should be doing it in-house.
Mm.
And so, of course, they did. And that was the end of me, which was fine. Mm. You know, it was great while it lasted. When I said proud, I'm pleased with the work that we did. But also, I'm equally nostalgic whenever I see Warburton's Bread mentioned, because Warburton's was a client of mine back in the day when Warburton's had 7 individual bakeries. So there was Leeds, there was Shaw, there was Bolton, obviously. Bolton has always been. And I used to do incentive schemes for their drivers, for their van drivers that used to go out to the shops if there was a new product, or if they were wanting to perk up something that had gone a bit low. So I've gone, that was good because the drivers, it kept the drivers on the, because they could earn lots of nice stuff. We used to do a catalogue, so the drivers could pick what they wanted. But that was how they operated now. Not how they're one big, huge organisation. But that was back in the day when they were a smaller and, but nevertheless, you know, very hardworking organisation.
Now, Judith, I remember a while ago you telling me you got to work with Henry Cooper,
yes,
the boxer.
I did. He wasn't boxing. It was when he was splashing it all over with Brute. And we used to buy a lot of product because we would get Brute from the House of Fabergé, the Brute aftershave. So it was brilliant when we were doing lots of gifts for after dinner for big conferences, for sale conferences. And you wanted something nice. You could put the Brute with a golf towel with a logo on it for the men. And Fabergé also did fragrances. So we'd have nice fragrance sets for the ladies. We also got involved with a lot of trade shows with Fabergé, just to kind of cut a long story short. Henry Cooper would come along to the trade shows and he was delightful. We'd be told he was going to be there for an hour. He'd stay for hours. He never expected anything for nothing. He admired a beautiful tea service. And I could tell by the people's face that they thought he was expecting it to be delivered to his house. And he said, my wife would love that. He went into his inside pocket and he pulled out his checkbook and he said, would you like me to pay for it now or when you deliver it? You know, and he would look around, he would look at the crowd and people would be gathered around. And if he saw somebody that was a wheelchair user or somebody who looked to be on the fringe of it, he would seek them out and he'd go and talk to them. He was never shortchanged anybody. He was the most delightful man. And just a joy to be with him. And that was an enduring memory. You know, there was no celebrity status about him at all.
And did he pay for the tea service?
Yeah, of course he did. And he would always say, and how are you? And is the show going well? And what are you doing? You know, he would talk about how we were doing. You know, he'd always want to know, were we busy? What it had been like? Wherever we took him, he'd be straight in there, totally focused.
So you cross paths quite often.
On the view. Well, yeah, it was just because we did lots of trade shows. How it all worked out is more boring than it's all worky stuff that you don't want. It's not interesting. It was just sufficient to say that as part of the Fabergé helping us to provide all these gifts that we would get given away in right quarters, Henry Cooper came as part of the package, making personal appearances.
Brilliant.
And it worked out very well because, of course, he was very well known then and people were thrilled to meet him.
So let's fast forward to the Isle of Man then. How did you actually get to be employed and move to the Isle of Man?
Well, actually, I didn't come to the island with an agenda at all. What happened was, just to tail off that business, we were going along happily. We were doing sales promotion and the agencies were doing all the above-the-line advertising. And then they thought, hang on a minute, we should be doing the sales promotion. And so they just went to their clients and said, we can do the whole thing. And so people like me were redundant. I kind of knew it was always going to be like that. But we had a great time. It lasted a good long time. Like 20 years out of it, you know. I was at a crossroads. The business had come to a natural end. The clients didn't want to deal with small people like me. They wanted it all in one place. So here's me at the crossroads there's got my father that doesn't want to come and live in the house that he's chosen in the Isle of Man. There's me that's really got no business, wants to live in the Isle of Man. And so I came over here with no agenda whatsoever. But through coming on holiday, I had started to develop friendships. So I came over here and then I got tricked into joining the Thought for the Day rota, which was very funny because there was somebody I'd become friendly with through church. She was on a 5-year contract here. She was on the Thought for the Day rota. She knew she was leaving. She didn't want to leave a gap in the rota. And she said to me, you could do that. And I said, no, I couldn't. So she said, no. She said, I know you can't do it now. But she said, there's a training evening at St. John's. She said, go to St. John's and go to the training evening. And it was free to get in, but you had to pay to get out. And you had to pay to get out by signing up to join the Thought for the Day rota.
So just to explain what Thought for the Day was.
It was just, we used to have, up until COVID, which really was the, was the end of it, it was literally on Manx Radio, a person, maybe a church, an ordained person, maybe not, maybe just a member of the laity, would do a series of five thoughts for the day. Couple of minutes in length, and they used to be played out before the 7 a.m. news, and they used to be played out again just after midnight, repeated. So they were played twice, Monday to Friday. There was a big rota of people to reflect all kinds of thoughts and strands of belief. That was what it was. It was produced by the wonderful Jim Francier. He used to do the recording and put them on 8-track cartridges for play out. So I joined the rota for that. And from that, I then got invited to join a smaller rota for the Sunday morning programme that Brian Partington, he was Reverend Brian Partington then. Brian did it for 27 years, the Sunday morning programme, which could be anything from interviews, book reviews, that kind of thing. Now, Brian, his responsibilities were increasing. He was very involved with hospice. He was involved with sport on the Isle of Man. He was also going to be made the Archdeacon. So after 27 years doing the radio, when he was a vicar, he could see that he needed to step away from that. And so he was building up a rota to take over. And so I joined that rota. And then in one glorious moment, George Ferguson was looking for somebody to take on Sunday night because he was doing a switch around of the weekend presenters. And he came in to the studio one Friday morning when there were about three or four of us in with Charlie Webster, who was the producer for the Sunday morning. So we were in with Charlie. George breezed in and he said, I need somebody for Sunday nights. He said, one of you lot will do. He said, you're out and about on a Sunday, aren't you? So when I looked round, all my colleagues were all under the desk. He said, well, you'll have to do it then. And so...
And that's how it began.
That's how it began.
Did you find broadcasting comfortable when you first started?
No. I was terrified. Still am. I mean, there's something I should have mentioned when we were talking about Liverpool is that my entire family were Radio Caroline obsessed. But I didn't believe that Ramsey existed. I thought it was a magical place that was just so wonderful, that had this ship riding at anchor, you know. And I was in the Tom Lodge fan club and I got a picture of Radio Caroline, black and white postcard with a little ship. Right, there could have been absolutely anything. But I thought it was wonderful. You know, went up on the wall. But what I'm saying is that I loved everything about music. That was stitched into me right from from my childhood, listening to Brian's, my uncle's records, and then everybody being obsessed with Radio Caroline. My mother loved it. She had it on the whole time. So that was in me. The idea of doing a music programme on the radio, I thought, well, that'd be pretty good, wouldn't it? But the idea of opening the microphone and talking, but you see, this is where enter stage left, the wonderful Bernie Quayle, because George said, Bernie will train you. And
Bernie was the late night presenter, wasn't he, during the weekdays back then?
And so I already knew Bernie because I was coming in to do production work for the Sunday morning programme. So Bernie would be doing his show and I'd be in the next studio doing production work. So, you know, I knew what was going on. And so George said, you see Bernie, Bernie will train you. I would come and sit in and then he would let me do the last hour. The first show that I did, it was beginning of September 93. So I should be better than I am now, shouldn't I? But never mind, let's gloss over that. That was going to be my first show. And Bernie said, well, he said, there you go. You're in the studio. He said, I'll be in the library. And so he was in the library. I survived the show. He said, did you enjoy it? I said, oh, I said, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I said, I was really nervous. He said, oh, he said, you were fine with the music. Your music was fine because it was choose your own music, you know. So I said, OK, great. I said, I'll see you next week. He said, what do you mean see me next week? He said, I'm not coming in again on a Sunday. No, he said, you're fine. I tell you, Dave, I was just terrified. Every time I thought about it through the week, it came out in a cold sweat. But to be honest with you, I don't think, if you're not a little bit, how shall I describe it? Not on edge, then you're not putting enough into it, because I come in the studio on a Sunday night and I sit down and I, you know, get all the toys around us that we have to have now. And I think, I hope I can do this. I don't think this is a piece of cake. Never, ever, ever think that. Never. And I don't want to think, because I think if I think, well, there's nothing to this, I think that's disrespectful to if there's a listener, if there happens to be a listener out there. Because, you know, this is the thing about radio. We are in people's homes and they deserve the best that we can give them. And I feel passionately about that.
Good.
I really do. And I still regard it as a privilege, and I still love doing it, and I still love hunting around for the music. It's tricky because, you know, as a presenter, that there's a lot of the old favourites that people just love hearing. And so we've got to strike that balance, haven't
we? Exactly. The Late Show on a Sunday is not your only bow.
Well, I do my Sunday morning programme, At Your Service, which, again, I love doing because the people that you meet are very different. I try to make as much variety in what we cover there, you know, be it from new members of the clergy who come to the island, or visitors who've got a particular interest or a particular cause or a particular experience that they've had. So try to get a bit of variety there. And, of course, I love the Guild and I love doing the coverage of that. But I absolutely love working with the material from the archive room that my lovely colleague Tim Price, he is digitally remastering all the analogue recordings that we have from wonderful people like David Collister, who did so much. And when you put together all his work, you realise what he gave us and the wonderful stories that he got out of these people. I love listening to that. Re-editing it, maybe to fit themes or to make people with similar backgrounds, put them together. I love doing that. I love working on the archive and making those into programmes for Island Life.
Away from Manx Radio in the Isle of Man, what keeps you busy?
I'm very involved in church things that are outside of church buildings. And there is a lot of that that's going out and saying, what does the community need that the church can provide? It's working on that side of things. I also do have the privilege of helping to lead services in our own church, which is a little church, St. Stephen's in Sulby. And that's a great privilege and a great joy. At a little family church, you know, we all know each other, support each other. New joiners always welcome.
And just while you're on that, so is putting that service together a little bit like putting together a radio programme?
It is, but you don't have quite as much freedom. Because although you know, you're smiling while you're saying this, but I do try to be a bit creative with music. Obviously, we want hymns that people know and love and can sing along to, but I do like to put in a little bit of music so we have a quiet time and a bit of reflection and listen to something nice that perhaps is not suitable to sing along with, but it perhaps has a reference to the scripture of the day. You know, I enjoy doing that kind of thing, being a little bit creative. If I'm invited to go take a service in a church that's got perhaps screens, which a lot of them have now, that's great because you can, in a different way, you can be more creative and perhaps use some video, make a little reflective time using video, and that kind of thing is quite easy to do now. The message is always the same, but it's trying to present it in a way that says to people, just have a look at this and see if this helps you, if this speaks to you. Because that's really what it's about in developing a spiritual relationship. It's trying to offer as many ways, not changing the message. The message will always be the same, but not trying to dumb it down or simplify it, because I don't believe that's what people want. But just present it in a way that maybe makes a little oasis for people to rest in. Life is pretty fraught these days. You know, it's about saying there's hope, and there's strength, and there's something here that would help you. Not putting people under pressure, not making people feel guilty, and not changing the essential message that, you know, we've got to set the bar high in the lives that we live. The other thing that I love doing is if I get invited to go along to social groups and tell ridiculous stories about the various scrapes that I've got into over the years. I've got one that's called Travel Broadens the Mind. It's not what you think it is. It's just beware of self-cleaning toilets.
Sounds like Japan.
And things like that, yes. I've never been to Japan.
Oh, okay.
I'm very well travelled, you know. I've been to York, I've been to Stratford-on-Avon. You know, I've been to London. You know, but it's just things that when you look back, you think, God, you know, did that really happen? And you can collect these kind of things. And I love that because you meet people and you try and tell them something that is a bit amusing and have a little natter and a cup of tea and a bit of cake. And I like doing that. There's always something to do. And you see, this is the beauty of this island. There is always something to do if you keep your eyes open. There's somewhere to go, something to do, something to lend a hand with. It doesn't mean you have to interfere in everything. But you perhaps see something and you think, oh, yeah, well, if they need an extra person there, you know, perhaps I could go and make the tea or whatever. And so that's, you know, there's always plenty to do like that. There are a few things that are my particular little things that I carry with me. And I'm involved in, I'm part of a team of people who are trying to provide, when I say a retreat house, it's a place of retreat. And we are moving to a new place for this, which is a lovely house off near the Selby River in the area of the Gairy in the north of the island. And just they're offering day and half-day gatherings for people to just come away, and maybe they'll be led by somebody with a theme. Maybe it'll just be a place to come and just chill out for half a day. There's absolutely beautiful mature gardens, so you can have a wander around and, you know, just sit under a tree and just relax. And that's, I think that is very, very important to provide that. And so I'm very involved in that. It's called Tai De Vay, which means House of Life in Manx. Got to have a Manx name. So I'm very involved, and I'm, as part of a group of people, very involved in that. When I'm absolutely on my own, I play guitar very badly. I play piano even more badly, but love it all deeply. And I've got 7 dolls' houses. But we'll just move on swiftly from that.
You've achieved so much. Is there anything else left for you to achieve, do you think?
Do you know what? I look back, Dave, and I don't think I've achieved anything at all. I think I look back and I see lots of missed opportunities. I have no ambition whatsoever. I have one ambition, is to know when I'm past it before somebody has to gently take me by the elbow and say, stop it. That might be your responsibility. That's my ambition, just to know, step away. I will never get over the privilege of being able to live here and all the things that I've mentioned on this island that I've been able to do and loved, and lots of other things that I've done over the years that I have loved so much, and wonderful people that I've met. I just like to be able to do a bit more radio for a little bit longer, if that's okay with the powers that be. And I will just go poking around and seeing what else I can interfere in the meantime, that people would let me be kind enough to let me come out and play with them.